Okay, good morning. Can we start? You're ready? Okay. Before we consider algorithms for defect interpolation as we have motivated it last Monday, we will summarize a few basic properties of the Fourier transform that you should be aware of and that you should have heard in the context of other lectures like systems and signals or lectures like that, or mathematics, basic mathematics lectures. So the Fourier transform is defined as a basis transform in terms of linear algebra. You take here the nth roots, unit roots, and you build up a new function by a linear combination of unit roots using your original signal. For those of you who still have no good feeling what it is actually doing, always replace the e to the power of minus I by the cosine and sine functions and write it down, and then you mentally build up the correlation with the Fourier series that all signals, periodic signals, can be represented by a linear combination of sine and cosine functions. And the Fourier transform is nothing else but, representing the signal in terms of its frequencies. And that's also why we call the original signal to sit within the spatial domain. If we talk about images, if we talk about speech signals, time signals, we talk about the time domain. So that's the spatial domain in image processing. And this here is the frequency domain where we transform the signal using the Fourier transform. For the Fourier transform, you have to know the complexity of the Fourier transform is quadratic. It's a linear mapping. It's nothing else but a matrix vector multiplication. If you look at this, this is the inner product of roots of the unit roots multiplied here in the 1D case with a 1D signal F0, F1, up to Fn minus 1. That's just an inner product written in terms of a sum. And then you can do this for all the size, and you get a matrix vector multiplication. And this is known to have the basic complexity of n square. We can reduce the complexity by using the fast Fourier transform. Also, this is something you should be aware of. We bring the complexity down to n log n using the idea of the fast Fourier transform with a butterfly operation that you might have heard in other lectures of. That's. Hi, you're even knocking at the door. That's. Yeah, well educated. Very good. Your name is Ludwig, right? I remember. Okay. So these things are not that much important for us in this context. So if you do not remember this exactly, this is not a disaster. If you implement the algorithms, it's always better to use state-of-the-art techniques and efficient techniques. But if you know about MATLAB, and we are using MATLAB within the exercises, you are not required to know that much about the Fourier transform because there is a library function that does it all for you. So, and now let's talk about a few basic properties. We use the Fourier series idea to show that the discrete sampling of a continuous function should be done in a way that the sampling frequency is greater than twice the maximum frequencies that shows up in the signal. So what do you have to keep in mind if you have a function, let's say x1, x2, and for instance, you have a function like this. We know that this periodic function can be rewritten by a superposition of cosine and sine functions. And we know that these coefficients here, yeah, they define the signal. And if this sum here is finite, if the sum here is not infinite but finite, we can represent the whole continuous signal by using just the AKs and BKs that we have to know, right? And if the sum is infinite, like in this case where we have this discontinuity, then all the frequencies, all the higher frequencies show up in the signal. So if we want to sample a function, let's say a discrete function, and we want to sample it, that means we just take the function values at discrete positions on the x1 axis, then the answer is we need a sampling frequencies that is twice as much as the maximum frequency that shows up within the signal. So if a signal is band limited or frequency limited, that means for a certain frequency, all the AKs and BKs are zero, or the Fourier transform is zero for sigma larger than B, then we know that we can compute out of this boundary frequency here the frequency of our sampling. Yeah, that's very fast repetition of what you should learn within other lectures. So if a function is band limited, no infinitely high frequencies within the signal, we know how to sample the signal. And this will play an important role later on for defect interpolation, as we will see in a few minutes. Hello. The other property we need to know is, this is very intuitive, right? So don't worry, this is not a proof or so. So don't tell your dad, look what he has shown today with hand-waving arguments. He has introduced the sampling theorem. There is way more to tell about this. But for our understanding of the upcoming algorithms, this is totally sufficient. Then we talk about convolution. May I ask, who in the audience has never ever heard about convolution of two signals? You all have heard about this. Perfect. So if you convolve two signals, you can rewrite the convolution in spatial domain as a product in the frequency domain. Yeah? And you can also turn around this argument and say if you convolve the Fourier transforms, this corresponds to a multiplication in the spatial domain, because in Fourier transform, forward Fourier transform and inverse Fourier transform are both Fourier transform. What is the difference between the Fourier transform and its inverse? You remember that? What is the difference? Scaling factor. It's just the sign in the exponential, right? So you have e to the power of minus something, and the inverse is just the minus sign. Yeah? And then the mathematicians in the audience might say, well, that's not true. There is a scaling factor that has to be adapted. Yes. But in engineering, usually we don't care about scaling factors. Yeah? Don't quote me. Yeah, don't quote me. But scaling factors is something that I always fix at the end of the day if everything is working. Yeah? Scaling factors, constants, is something that more or less defocus your view towards things, and you might miss the important points. In many exercise problems, I usually ask the students to show that a convolution in the frequency domain corresponds to a product in the spatial domain, because this problem usually cannot be solved by using Google. Times have changed. When I was a student, professors, just came up with the with the exercise problems, and we had to think about how to solve it. Now the task is for the guy who is coming up with the exercise problems, come up with a problem that cannot be Googled. Yeah? And it's always nice for me to see the homework solutions, and sometimes I also get an answer like, I couldn't find it with Google, I don't know what to do. Yeah, so times have changed. Okay, how can we prove this? How can we prove this? In a few seconds. Prove the convolution theorem. Well, just plug things in, right? So we want to compute the Fourier transform of G. That is, just by definition, the Fourier transform is f of x. I do it in the continuous, e to the power of minus I cx. I forget about the 2 pi and things like that, dx. Yeah, that's just the definition. That's just the definition of the Fourier transform. Yeah? You agree? And now I plug in the convolution. So the convolution is f t times, h? X minus t dt e to the power of I cx dx. So that's just the definition of the convolution in the continuous. Now we switch back and forth between the continuous and the discrete by just replacing the integral by a sum. Yeah? As an engineer, we always use the discrete or continuous depending on what's easier to deal with in all the formulas. Yeah? Okay. What do we do next? What do we do next? We massage the equation, right? We just move things around. Yeah? We move things around. So what we see is, I still have too much energy for today. What do? We say, okay, this is Ft. And then we know that Ft is independent of the variable x, so we can bring it out of one integral. And then we have a of h of x minus t times e to the power of x dx dt. Yeah. And now, what are we doing now? We try to get rid of this here. This is close to be a Fourier transform, yeah, except the transformation there, x minus t. So we do a coordinate transform and say we replace, we replace what? X by x plus t. If I replace x plus t, the t disappears here. Okay? So within this integral, I do a coordinate transform. I replace the x by x plus t. So I have ft integral. If I plug in here, x plus t minus t is what? It's x. If I plug in here, x plus t dx dt, I can break this up into a product of two exponential functions. It's e to the power of I minus I xi x times e to the power of minus I xi t. Xi t is independent of x, so I can bring it out. Okay? So that's what I do next. It's integral ft integral. Oh, that's an h here. Nobody told me. It's an h, right? It was an h. hx still a problem somewhere? No. To the power of minus I xi t dt. And that's all that we wanted to do. This here is the Fourier transform of H. This here we bring up there, and that's the Fourier transform of T of F. Yeah? So this is F times H. So with very basic mathematics, we were able to show the convolution theorem. Okay? Questions? No. So that's the convolution theorem. I put the proof here, and you see it's just the same idea in the discrete, is using basically nothing else but the ideas I have presented so far. Okay? Good. Then we have to have a summary of another property of the Fourier transform that is not that heavily used so far in signal processing, like the convolution theorem that is way more important. But for our algorithm that we are going to design today, this is a very crucial property. And the question is, what happens to a function that is real valued within the Fourier transform? I mean, we can Fourier transform a real valued function. We can also Fourier transform, a complex valued function. Yeah? So what is special with a Fourier transform of a real valued function? And the nice thing is that in signal processing, if we use measurements, usually we have real valued functions. Our microphone is giving us real values. Our image detector is giving us real values for each pixel. And if we apply the Fourier transform, what are the properties of the Fourier transform of a real valued signal? And there is a very nice property in the discrete. If I Fourier transform a function, real valued function f, the Fourier transform of at the point xi is the conjugate at the point n minus xi. Yeah, so I have my Fourier transform from 0 to n minus 1 values, and the value at the point xi is the same as at the position n minus xi, but not exactly the same, but the conjugate of that. And this property can be used for algorithms. And let's show the proof. The proof is not so hard. Again, we look at the Fourier transform at n minus xi and the conjugate of that. So what do? We just replace here the formula for the Fourier transform at this point and have this conjugate here, the conjugate bar. So just the definition at the point n minus xi and the conjugate of that. Now, we can bring in the conjugate component-wise. We know about the rules, how to apply the conjugate to a product, to a sum. So we can bring it in and compute the conjugate of each element of the sum, and we look at the prefactor and the nth unit root. So we get the conjugate here, and the conjugate of the exponential function here is just a switch within the sign. You should remember this out of first year math class. So that's the conjugate of the Fourier transform. And now we know if this is real valued, what does that mean? If that is real valued, the conjugate of a real value is the same. So we can just forget about here the bar. And now I bring in again here the minus sign. Where does it come from? Well, it's just here that I switched the difference, the ordering of the difference. Huh? Okay, and then I know the unit roots. I always have to keep in mind how the unit roots sit in the space. So if you look at the sphere or at the circle of length 1, you know that the unit roots are just here these vectors And if you have a vector, you can either go this way or you can go this way and get the same value. Yeah, that's the symmetry property we are using here. And if you plug this in here, you get exactly the theorem that we have seen on the previous slide. So due to the symmetry property, we can show that the Fourier transform at xi is the same as the Fourier transform at n minus xi conjugate. Okay? And that's a cool property. We should remember this. Here are a few other properties. Scaling property, if you scale the argument of a function, the Fourier transform looks like that. If you have the shifting, you get this prefactor. That's something we have used here, for instance. Yeah? If you transform the signal, you just get a prefactor here. Then you have a symmetry property. If you look at the function at point minus xi, you get this type of property. And if you apply differentiation, you basically make use of the fact that the Fourier transform is a linear mapping that can be expressed in terms of matrix vector multiplication in 1D, and you have this property for the differentiation. Okay, good. And now we talked last week already, no, on Monday, about interpolation in the spatial domain. You remember the piecewise linear approximation, and you just put a linear function between two samples, and then you compute the function value at the sample point. Now we will do defect interpolation in the frequency domain. Good. And now let's think about this in more detail. Is there anybody in the audience who has already visited the Medizintechnik Museum here in Erlangen? Yeah, you visited already? Is it good? Is it worth?
It's not big.
Okay, so size matters for the quality of a museum, or what does it mean? Was it good or not?
It was good.
Well, it's a Siemens Medizintechnik Museum. Huh? I mean, what do we expect? To show how good the others are? No.
Yeah, but sometimes it's better that you look better in comparing with another. If you compare yourself with another, then you...
Yeah, but that would not be good for the others in this case. Well, I haven't been there. Yesterday I met the manager of the museum, and I promised that I'm going to visit. So, should we have a joint visit? You want to join me? No? I will schedule a meeting with her, and then I'll tell you. So, 10, 15 students can join me. Yeah, and we can ask intelligent art questions. That you know, bring the guide to the borderline. Yeah, that happened to me. You might know that we developed the Adidas One shoe with a smart cushioning in the heel. And I went to an Adidas store in Hamburg and went there as a potential customer. And I just wanted to know what the salesperson knows about the shoe. Yeah, and within 2 seconds, I noticed that I know way more than this guy. It was a very nice conversation. And I'm pretty much sure that the sales guy, he was so pissed by me. Okay. We have to cut this out. Uh-oh. He was so annoyed by my comments, you know. Yeah, it's exactly what he thought, idiot. Okay. It's the same if you visit the radiology department, yeah? I mean, then you start to ask questions, what type of reconstruction algorithm does the CTE method uses, and so it's a good way to become friends. Okay, now we are not talking about getting friends, we talk about defect pixel interpolation. Now let's think about the following, yeah? I'll just draw a figure to make it intuitively clear. These things you remember usually way better than slides and formulas. So this is an image, yeah? And let's think that my heart was, how to get friends, my heart was scanned, yeah? So you see my heart, but the detector is defect, yeah? The detector looks like this. And this is a defect column. A defect column. And now we can look at a row and plot the row here. Yeah? So we look at the row. So we get here our intensity value. And, or let me write it, I intensity value, and here I get the x coordinate of the row. So what happens, I have here noise, yeah, then my heart starts to come in here, and I get this type of signal, and then I have the drop of the signal where it's just zero because the pixels are defect, and then my heart is coming back this way. That's how the intensity values look like if I walk along this image line. If I look, what are the intensity values? Yeah, everybody got this? I looked at one line and the intensity value plot. And this here is a discontinuity. Discontinuity. That means, in other words, if I take this signal and if I compute the Fourier series of it, or the Fourier transform, I have here a discontinuity. Is it a problem to have a discontinuity? In principle, no, because the Fourier transform can deal with it. The Fourier series can also, you know, deal with discontinuities. It just takes the function values in between here for the Fourier transform. But if you have high differences in the signal, high difference in the signal, that implies that you have high frequencies in the signal. And that means this signal here with a defect will not be band limited. Yeah? You have a drop of the signal to zero, it's no longer band limited. So what we can say is that the Fourier transform of this function with a defect will for sure run into the problem that the Fourier transform will not be achieving zero values for a certain threshold psi. Okay? So the function with a defect is no longer band limited. And the idea now is the following, to say, okay, I Fourier transform this, I cut off all the frequencies that are larger than B setup with your detector. You know that the band limitation frequency B is given. You cut off it and you do a back transformation and you will get rid of the high frequencies. And then you take the signal values right here in the area of the defects and you put in the values of the back transform, Fourier transform, and you will get a signal like this. Still high frequencies, you do again the same game, you Fourier transform, you cut off the high frequencies, and at some point within this iteration process, the defect interpolation will bring up signal values that do not violate the band limitation of the signal. That's the idea. Huh? So if you have dropouts, if you have discontinuities in your signal, you have invalid pixels, that means that you have a signal loss at this point that implies a high frequency in your signal. High frequencies imply that the band limitation of the function is no longer there, and you can enforce this band limitation by the game Fourier transform, cutoff frequencies, back transform, fill in the estimated values, Fourier transform, cutoff, back transform, fill in the values, and by this iterative scheme, you can restore the signal. So, according to the sampling theorem, the ideal signal is required to be band limited. Yeah, we know it by Nyquist-Shannon theorem regarding to a certain band frequency psi. Okay, then if we have defects in our detector, this brings the corresponding pixels down to zero. So you have really a signal drop-off. Then the defect pixels will cause high differences in the signal. So from one value to the from one pixel to the other pixel, you have high differences. These high differences imply high frequencies. And these higher frequencies cause a violation of the band limitation. That's the trivial idea. And the idea for defect interpolation, replace defect pixels iteratively by enforcing band limitation using the Fourier transform. How does the algorithm look? Yes, sir?
So I wonder, isn't it a lot like we are filtering with a low-pass filter and then it's okay too?
Yeah, so it's like filtering with a low, I mean, it's nothing else but a low-pass filter. Yeah.
Don't we normally do it by applying a low-pass filter directly in the special domain?
Of course, you can emulate this by using a proper low-pass filter. That's for sure. Yeah. But again, it's important that you do not low-pass filter the whole image, but you low-pass filter the whole image and just replace the defect pixels using, and then get the new one and then low-pass filter again. Replace the defect filters in the original image and do this iteratively. This is nothing else but a low-pass filter, yeah? It's nothing else but a low-pass filter. So compute the Fourier transform of the input signal. We get our defect image, we compute the Fourier transform. We compute the Fourier transform and look for those points where the band limitation has to be enforced. So we set these values of the Fourier transform to zero. Yeah, that's the low pass characteristics. Then we compute the inverse and now replace the defect samples in the original signal by the inverse Fourier transform values at this point. Yeah? So that means we compute the Fourier transform, cut it off, we back transform, we get these values, and we don't take the whole signal in terms of its inverse Fourier transform, but we just take out these elements that are covering the defect pixels and bring it back to the original signal with the effect that this that was measured with valid detector elements is not modified by this filtering operation. Yeah? And this is done iteratively until changes are minor and we say that we are happy with the result. What are the drawbacks? Of course, if you enforce band limitation, you have to know the frequencies. What are the boundary frequencies? The interpolation scheme is computationally expensive because we have to apply the Fourier transform twice. We can solve this by designing low-pass filters in spatial domain properly. The proposed interpolation algorithm is not optimal with respect to the number of non-zero frequencies. So if you want to have an interpolation scheme that results in intensity values with a minimum number of non-zero frequencies, this is not the way it can be done. The extrapolation decay outside the observation interval is a problem. Extrapolation, we know, we have samples and we want to have estimates. So if you have defects on the boundary, you have a problem. Within the frequency domain and the application of adaptive thresholding during interpolation is advantages. What is adaptive thresholding? Adaptive thresholding is that you look at the intensity values and you have thresholds for the intensity values For instance, if a value is above a certain value, you bring it down to a fixed value, and this is adaptively changed by the iteration or within the iterations of the algorithm. We will maybe also implement this algorithm in MATLAB. It's very easy to be done, and the results are quite impressive. A way better algorithm that is working within the frequency domain will be introduced on the following slides. And this method will make heavily use of the symmetry properties. And let me just bring you back to the idea that I have briefly introduced last Monday. If you look at the formalization of the defect generation, you can say I have the ideal image. You can say I have the defect mask with zeros and ones, and zeros I have at those points where the defects are. I multiply these two images pixel-wise, and I get here this, okay? And this is the image, the observed image with defects. And so I have here the multiplication of F times W results in G. And the product within the spatial domain corresponds to what in the frequency domain? The convolution. Yeah? So we have F convolved with W is G. And if I want to compute the original signal given W and G, I have to compute the ratio of the G pixel values by the W pixel values. The problem is the points where we are interested in, we have zero entries, and so we get a singularity. So we cannot divide by zero, period. That's not possible. Yeah, so you will get no result on this. But maybe we can do something here in the frequency domain by deconvolving this signal that we measure, knowing the mask image W. And that's exactly what we are going to do now. We look into the frequency domain and this type of convolution I have mentioned here. So again, the observed signal is the ideal image multiplied pixel-wise, yeah, component-wise with the mask image. You agree on that? Yes, very simple. Then we have the same relationship in the frequency domain by using, instead of the multiplication, the convolution. And then we can make use of the fact that the signals that we measure are real-valued signals. Yeah? These are images. Images have intensity values. These are real-valued signals. So the Fourier transforms will use or will fulfill this property that f at the frequency xi is the same as conjugate f at the frequency n minus xi. Now, that's what we have shown a few minutes ago on one of the slides where we have mentioned the theorem. Yeah? And the symbol z bar, the bar is the conjugate complex. Is there anybody in the audience who has no idea what the conjugate complex is? No. Huh? If you have a complex number, let's say z a plus ib, the conjugate complex is a minus ib. Yeah? And the Eulerian writing is you take the length of the vector ab, that means the absolute value of c e to the power of minus I phi, where phi is the angle induced by A and B. So if you are in the complex domain and this is A and this is B, here you have your phi. Yeah? The conjugate complex here is just Z plus I phi. That's the way we consider this. Yeah, and the norm of C is just the length of the vector, so that's a square plus b square and the square root of that. Just for those of you who do not remember, those who remember can just check whether I remember it correctly. Okay? What is your personal relationship to complex numbers? You live with them and you can deal with them, or you still think, oh my God?
I know how to deal with them.
Okay. So you appreciate to see complex numbers? Yeah? Okay. Okay. I mean, for a student, I mean, having an absolute value which is a horror by itself, you know. You also have this I here, it's disaster. Yeah, complex numbers and absolute values. So. Usually I feel way better to think about vectors, bring it back to linear algebra, and at some point there is some hope that SVD will deal with all the problems. Which is actually not true in this case, but okay, good. Now, We do a trick. Instead of looking at the whole Fourier transform, we look at pairs. And we look at selected pairs. We look at G at point S and G at point N minus S, the Fourier transform of the measured signal. And we also look at the Fourier transform of the ideal signal at point S and N minus S. Instead of looking at the whole Fourier transform, we just look at pairs, different pairs in different steps of the algorithm. Yeah? We look at pairs. And if you say the function, the Fourier transform at position k should be rewritten or represented just by the two elements at the two selected frequencies, s and n minus s, or in this case, k and n minus k, I can write this with the original Fourier transform f hat using the Dirac function. Is there anybody in the audience who cannot read this? That's a usual trick in signal theory, how to select certain values within a function. And the Dirac function is defined as follows. The Dirac function is 1, for our purposes here, there are different ways to look at it, for our simplistic views on things. The Dirac function is 1 if n is 0 and 0 otherwise. So just in those cases where the argument of the Dirac function is 0, we will have here a factor of 1. And if this is non-zero, this factor is 0, and so the whole thing will be disappearing here within the signal. So we look at the signal at points where k is equal to s, so we get the value fs. Yeah? So this is only 1 for k equal to s. We will get the function value f hat s. And here, this will only be 0 if k is equal to n minus s. Only if k is equal to n minus s, this here will be 0. And then we will get this element. So if I look at all possible values of k, just for two values of k, I get two non-zero values of this function. That's the way how you should read it, okay? We will use this also later for defining the reconstruction algorithm, so keep this in mind. Yeah? If you have to rewrite discrete functions, the Dirac function is doing usually a great job and helps us to do that. And what we now can do is, we can now rewrite the convolution using, instead of the Fourier transform of the whole function we want to reconstruct, the Fourier transform at two selected points, S and N minus S. Yeah? So if you go now into this formula here, with a convolution, and you plug in this definition of f here with the Dirac function, you will find out that also your convolution in the frequency domain collapses. Yeah, you will just get two elements. If you plug this in, you will get the function at the position S and the Fourier transform of the mask image at position 0. And here you get the conjugate complex Fourier transform at S and the Fourier transform of the mask at point 2S. Yeah? So how do you get this formula? Once again, you just plug in here the definition of the convolution in the discrete. We have seen this today, how the convolution is defined. You plug it in using the definition of F using the Dirac representation of the two pairs, and you get this type of representation. So you get GS is equal to this up to a scaling factor that we can ignore. Okay? Okay? That's cool. So we have W0, W2S, and here the function we are looking for. Once again, we have to compute F out of our observation G. F is the image where no defects are present. And we just look at pairs of our Fourier transform. We don't look at the complete Fourier transform. We just pick out pairs and look how these pairs generate the G or influence the G. Now I can do the following. I can look also at GS. What is the conjugate complex of GS? I mean, this is 1 over n. Then I get F hat S, W0 plus conjugate. Conjugate is the original value. S W 2S. And now I can rewrite this in terms of the original function at the point n minus S. Yeah, so this here is the original function at point n minus S. And what I see is, well, the W0, W2S, these are knowns because I have the mask image that's measured by setting up the X-ray system. And I have here unknowns, Fs and Fn minus S. And I have two equations with linear equations with two unknowns. So I can solve two equations. I can solve the two equations for G and G bar and solve it for Fs. And so I get a closed form estimate for Fs using the G values that I have measured and the W values that I get out of the original mask image. Yeah, that's cool. So by using just a reduced Fourier transform of the ideal image, by just looking at two pairs, yeah, I know that I can estimate the Fourier transform here at this point S and at the point F n minus s. And that's something I can do, and I can do it for different pairs. So I get estimates for the whole Fourier transform. If I select different values of s, I can solve this system of linear equations, just two of them. and I get different estimates for f. I can retransform the f and compare it to the measured image. And I can iterate now over the different image pairs up to a point where I minimize the error between the measured image in the spatial domain, the back transform, Fourier transform of the image I'm estimating, multiplied with the mask image. So I look how the image points are preserved by the defect interpolation that are measured before. Yeah? So I just look at those points that sit outside the defect pixel areas and look how much the measured signal deviates from the estimated signal at these points. Well, that's the idea of this algorithm. Let's go through it. let's go through it. So we compute the Fourier transform of the input signal. MATLAB, no problem, FFT, period. Then we randomly select a pair, S and N minus S, out of this signal. You just take randomly one value and the symmetric conjugate complex value, okay? Then we estimate the Fourier transform of F of the ideal signal at these 2 points by solving the two equations with the two unknowns. By just rewriting the convolution using the Dirac modified Fourier transform. Then we update our spectrum. So we have in this iteration process, we use different pairs and we plug in all the pairs that we compute. We update the function that we estimate and we compute the error that I have mentioned. So we do a back transformation, mask multiplication, and compare it to the measured signal. If the error is a buffer threshold, we update the error spectrum and we increment the iteration variable. So we go back and continue to Fourier transform it, and we do it until a threshold is hit in terms of the quality of the signal we get, and then we compute the inverse and get the estimate of our original signal. Okay? So instead of taking all the Fourier transform require band limitation, we take pairs and we iterate over pairs, estimate the pairs using just a solution of two linear equations with two unknowns, plug it in into the Fourier transform of the signal we look for. We check how well this original image that we, the ideal image that we estimate fits to the observation, and then we iterate that often until we get a very good estimate of our defect pixels. And it's amazing what you can do with this. Yeah? If you use a low-pass filter approach, you will never ever be able here to fill in this defect area. I mean, what do you see? You see a sphere, yeah, and you see an intensity gradient that is going down. The farther you're away from the center, the smaller the intensity value will be. If you plug it in, this defect signal, and do the algorithm I have described on the previous slide, you get this type of defect interpolated image. And it looks like the original. And now you might say, well, this is a very simple example. Yeah? I'm not excited at all. This is all symmetric and blah, blah, blah. And I don't trust you. Yeah? It's a small example. I don't like it. OK, so let's look at more complicated examples. So we have here a bone, and we have this horrible defect here. I mean, imagine what happens if a crack is here. You won't see it. And here we have also defects at the border. This is an artificial example. This is not something that you observe. What happens by interpolation? You get this type of interpolated image. You see here it's a little dark, so there are some interpolation artifacts. Here it's a little brighter here at the border. But if you look into this area from a certain distance, it looks pretty okay. Okay? So what you can do as a doctor, if you have somebody with a broken leg, you can take the system, you can capture an image, and you see the crack, and then you say, let's go to the other defect detector system. Then I won't see a crack anymore. And then you are fine again, you can go back home. I mean, there are certain limitations, yeah? I mean, this type of defect will never ever be in a system that is in the hospital. There are limitations where you can deal with them. Here are other examples where you have these bone structures and the defects, and they can be nicely interpolated. And the important thing here is also that the noise that is showing up in the image is also well considered within the interpolation scheme. So the noise is also in the interpolation areas present, and so your visual impression is very good if you look at these images. So never trust a image. Here is another example where we have this cross, and if you look into this here in detail, you see a little bit that there is an artifact. So still there are problems. After 1,000 iterations of the algorithm, I mean, you get pretty nice looking images where you can, if you know where the artifacts are, at least feel that there is something wrong. Now look at this. I should have separated the two images. If you really want to analyze the interpolation scheme, the best you can do is just take a noisy image and do interpolation. And here we have a noisy image. And we have here this huge defect area. And if you apply a low-pass filter to interpolate here, you will be lost. Yeah, you are just dead. But with the method that we have described in the past 15 minutes, if you apply it, you just carry the noise structure over to the defects and you don't really see what's happening there. The interesting thing is if you increase the number of iterations, you run into numerical instabilities and it starts at some point to come back the defect area and you see it. And that's also something which should tell you that you have to be cautious with numerical methods in image processing, because the analysis of the numerical stability of the algorithms you are looking at is something that you should be aware of. Yeah? It's not always that an iteration scheme is producing better results the more iterations you do. Yeah? The more iterations you do, you might also amplify certain errors, and at some point they come back and are visible again. Yeah? So be aware of that. Be aware of that. That's also why, by the way, if you look at modern CT systems, many modern CT systems claim that they have an iterative reconstruction method. What do you think if you hear iterative? You think something is done repetitively, right? So over and over again, iteratively. And the implementations that you will find at major vendors worldwide, not limited to our local one, is that they do just one iteration. They call it iterative reconstruction, and they just do one iteration, and then it starts to get worse. Yeah? Then they stop after one iteration. Another reason why you can stop after one iteration if the second one is not changing anything anymore. But very, very interesting to see these things. Okay. Now we talked about defects, and the important thing in engineering and research is also, you know, to understand solutions, to get a good intuition. I hope you got a good intuition on this algorithm without following up on all the details. That's something you can do at home, but you got a good intuition, so we can deal with defects. And when we do research in the lab, we address different problems in different medical image processing applications. And we also transfer algorithms from one domain into the other. And what happened to us was, for instance, I'll show you a few examples where we applied defect pixel interpolation. So the situation was nothing else but somebody shows up in our lab, explains us a problem. We say, whoa, it's brutally complicated. Give us 500,000 euros and we solve it. And we just apply the defect pixel interpolation algorithm and come up with a good solution. Yeah. So what was the problem we have considered? In endoscopy, yeah, you have always these glitchy surfaces, yeah, wet and glitchy. And if you do you say glitchy in English? You know what I mean. Yeah, it's just wet. Yeah, wet and shiny. Yeah, the language of the engineer is not English. You know that. Yeah, it's broken English. You know what I mean. So you have always these specular reflections here on this wet surface. Yeah, you have specular reflections, and that's basically saying there is an invalid signal. Yeah, you have invalid signal values. And the surgeon was telling us, I want to get rid of all these specular reflections because, you know, they are somewhat annoying and dependent on the illumination, carrying no information at all. It's just, you know, popping up features that I don't want to see within the image. And then we say, ooh, that's a complicated problem to eliminate that. And the idea was now the following. If you have these bright structures, you can easily detect these bright structures by using a thresholding operation, saying if the color value or the intensity value is above a certain threshold, it's a bright spot, a bright value within the image, and we classify the pixel to be a specular reflection image, image point. So we walk through the image, look at the bright values, and we say these bright values are specular reflections, and now the engineering work has to be done. Specular reflections do not carry valid image information. These are defect pixels, okay? So we build up this here with classified pixels with valid information, and those pixels where we have specular, where we have specular reflections, and we say these are defects, and then we put it into our defect interpolation algorithm, and we polish out all the specular reflections, and we get nicely looking images, and the doctors were so much excited. Yeah, it looked for them like a miracle. Yeah. And now you can charge industry for 500,000 euros and solve this problem with 10 lines of code.
Okay.
I'm exaggerating. It's not the case.
Maybe it's a mean question, but
there are no mean questions.
Oh,
there are stupid questions.
Okay, then I don't think it's a stupid question.
And intelligent ones.
Where is the looks very nice, but and the problem is maybe it's solved somehow, but where is the medical value? Because the doctor is not able to see anything. So we didn't bring information in he couldn't see before. He couldn't see.
Yeah, the problem is that if you have these bright spots, your eye is perceiving these bright spots. Yeah, so you look at the image and somehow you look at the bright spots because these are points that are some kind of special. And if you just smoothen these, your eye is not irritated by these or confused by these points. They are just disappear. Yeah, I'm not saying that we bring in additional information. We just regularize or normalize the image in a way that you do not get lost in details in the image that are not significant for the procedure. Yeah? Yeah, that's a valid comment. I mean, how long does it take if you work with image sequences? So if you have an endoscope and you capture images, let's say 25 images a second, you cannot allow for a delay more than 15 milliseconds. So your algorithm is constrained to this time window, and you have to implement it in a way that the processing, pre-processing is done in an efficient manner. And that's also why we have a lot of research ongoing in our lab where we do graphics card implementation or special hardware implementation for these algorithms. Mm-hmm. So we have time constraints. That's true. I'll also show to you another example where we have used this for supporting eye doctors. Now you say eye doctors, I'll show you the example. In ophthalmology, yeah, that's what eye doctors do. Ophthalmology, that's the word for that. In ophthalmology, the early diagnosis of diseases is done quite often on the basis of retina images. So the retina is the backside of your eye where all the nerve cells are that receive the signal, yeah, the image signal. And you have all been at an eye doctor, ophthalmologist, yeah, he looks into your eye and then he checks the background of your eye. Yeah? Or if you make a selfie and you see your eyes shining red, that's your retina. Yeah? That's just the way how the flashlight was reflected from the back of your eye and you see your retina. If you zoom in, if you have a very good camera, if you zoom in, then you will see your retina that looks like this here. Yeah? So you have the optical disc and you have your vessels coming out and then you see the structure of your inner eye. Glaucoma is one of the major causes for blindness in the Western world. That's the grüne Star, yeah, grüner Star. And it's important that you classify glaucoma in a very early stage. Then you can not solve the problem for the patient, but you can delay the progression of the disease, and the person can see way longer than without applying a therapy to the patient. So our goal is to find out patients with glaucoma disease in a very early stage. And our vision we still have in mind is to build a screening system, yeah? A low-cost screening system where you walk on Saturday morning through the pedestrian zone shopping, and at some point there is a fundus camera. You look into it, and after 5 milliseconds, you get the answer. You should go to the eye doctor and let's check it for glaucoma disease, or just go for a checkup. Yeah. So we want to compute risk factors for glaucoma disease. And if you want to do an automatic classification of these images here, we will see later on a few larger images. What is important is for classification, you want basically the decision high risk for glaucoma or low risk for glaucoma. Yeah? In terms of pattern recognition, that means two classes, glaucoma or not glaucoma, two classes. And if you have two classes, you want to compute features that are significant for the two classes. And now you have the property of the vessel system that this is very individual. So if you look at the retina images, you will see high variations in the vessel structure. It's like your fingerprint. It's very unique for you. Yeah? People also use it for the identification of people. Just look at the retina. And this high type of variation of the vessels leads to the fact that if you study these images, you basically get the high variations of the vessels and you don't get the two classes separated, glaucoma or non-glaucoma, because the signal is dominated by the vessels and the vessel structure if you look at these. Yeah. And in glaucoma, what you want to know is how does the rim look like here of the optical disc, because the rim, yeah, the rim of the optical disc is an indicator for glaucoma disease or not, if it changes, yeah, if it's getting wider or some color changes or things like that. And then right at that point, when we as pattern recognition guys noticed that the high variations of vessels is a problem, we just had the following idea. Why don't we just find the vessels in the image and say this is information that we do not need for classifying glaucoma disease. So we say the vessel points are defects, and we take our sandpaper and just wipe out the vessels, and we get retina images of the background of the eye without the individual vessel structures. That was the idea. And then we use these modified images for our classifier. And it turned out that this was a brilliant idea, because we were now able to do a way better classification with these polished vessel structures or these eliminated vessel structures than with the vessel structures. The vessel structures basically lead to features that have a very interleaved behavior within the feature space, and you are not able to separate the classes. Yeah? And that was a very cool idea, and that was very much appreciated in research. And people were very excited about this simple idea. And why did we come up with this idea? Because we work in X-ray and we had to deal with these flat panel detectors. And in our group, we discussed the problem, and at some point somebody comes up with the idea, why don't we do that? We try it within one day, and then we come up with a smart solution nobody has looked at. And recently I was attending a meeting for eye doctors within the region. So they go to the university and get a training on most recent methods. And I have shown to them these images, and they were very much excited about this. So you see here retina image with the segmented vessels. We set the vessel values to zero and apply our sandpapering algorithm or our inpainting algorithm and eliminate the vessel structure. And this is a type of image eye doctors have never seen before. Yeah, I mean, you look at the images and you just try to ignore the vessels, and then you focus on the structure on the retina without the vessels. But that's something that was done mentally before. And here we have generated an artificial image that you will never ever be able to measure with a sensor in exactly this way. So by image processing methods, we have eliminated the confusing individual structures, and now you can focus on the optical disc and on the nerve cells surrounding the optical disc, and you can analyze the structure of the optical disc, and you can use also these images for a later post-processing and classification. And that was a very, very cool idea. Very cool. So what are the take-homes regarding this chapter? Flat panel detectors are nowadays standard in X-ray imaging. If you go to a radiology department and you still see the image intensifier, you know they have outdated systems. Huh? They work, but this is technology that was present 15 years ago, but it's no longer state of the art. There are different principles that can be applied to convert X-ray particles into images. We have seen different types without looking into into details. Sorry for that. We have learned about defect pixel interpolation. We have seen spatial interpolation techniques by using neighboring pixels. We have seen frequency domain approaches where we enforce band limitation, that is more or less a low-pass filter that cuts out the high frequencies. We have seen that frequency domain method can be limited to two pairs using properties of the Fourier transform, can be reduced to a solution of two linear equations with two unknowns. Of course, you can solve this by SVD, but two unknowns, two equations, that's something we can do just closed form. And I just want you to be aware of the fact that these algorithms are rather powerful. Yeah? So you can eliminate defects to an extent where you say, from a medical point of view and diagnostic point of view, this is totally unacceptable. So these algorithms are powerful, and you have to be very cautious in applying these. We have repeated a few properties of the Fourier transform. If you felt uncomfortable with what I said about the Fourier transform, just go back home and sit down for 5 hours and repeat these things. Work hard on it. It's fun. If you don't have 5 hours to work on that, and you have basically developed the feeling within the lecture that you intuitively seem to know what's going on, that's sufficient. For me, at least. And we have also seen here with a few examples that it's always important for you to be aware of the methods, the toolbox you grow during your studies here, and really be fresh, a fresh thinker, and apply these things to problems where you originally have no thought of being a problem domain where these things can be applied. At some point, you can apply these crazy ideas to well-known problems and solve them properly. So that's something I also want to give you as a take-home message here at this point. So further readings, there are two major manufacturers for the flat panels. You can follow up on that. Varian, also Canon is building a detector, so if you are interested in the physics and the details on that, you can browse the vendor's webpage. If you are interested in the DQE, that's basically a measurement how well X-ray quanta are transformed into signals, you will find nice definitions and explanations within that. And one paper I like very much, it's already a little bit old now, it's 13 years old, and it's describing the idea of defect pixel interpolation in frequency domain using these two pairs of the Fourier transform. We also have here at our university in Professor Kaup's lab, I think PhD thesis projects, at least we had in the past, where these methods also were applied for interpolation. You know these. Yeah. And if you are interested in X-ray imaging and image quality issues, you can look at this webpage and find information on that. And if these are dead links, please let me know. Yeah, I recently received an email that some of these links already died. Let me know, then I will update it. Good. Any questions? No? Then we go into the next chapter, which is as exciting as this one, where we talk a little bit about magnetic resonance imaging. Are you tired? We talk about. So, if all pixels are defect and you interpolate, you get this type of image information. We will talk about magnetic resonance imaging now and the artifacts that are present in magnetic resonance imaging. And the problem that we are considering is that we are not able to come up with a homogeneous magnetic field within the MR scanner, but we have some inhomogeneities. And the inhomogeneities, they lead to images where you have parts that are brighter and parts that are darker showing up in the image. And the image is not homogeneous in its intensity distribution, but it's getting from dark to bright, for instance. You see this type of magnet gradient within the image. And the problem is that we look into how can we correct for this type of artifact within magnetic resonance imaging. So let's briefly look at the basic principles in magnetic resonance imaging. I have again to say I'm not a physicist, so I just know a few basics about magnetic resonance imaging, and there are way more and way better experts than I am. These systems look like, from a certain distance, very much like CT systems. Yeah, so you have this donut type of structure, you have here your table, but you have in there the magnet, and you can generate images out of the or of the inner of the human body using magnetic properties of the tissue and the human body. Magnetic resonance imaging started in the 80s to become a product, and the Nobel Award was given to the inventors in 2003. To the guys who invented it. It's also interesting to surf the web about the Nobel Prize in 2003, because the award was given to two inventors, and there was a third one who also contributed seriously to the invention of MR, and he was not awarded by the Nobel Prize, and he was very annoyed by that. And he made it very public, and it's very interesting to see how people react in this type of situation. So browse the web, it's very, very interesting to read also these historic things. And one of the awardees, for instance, was attending a conference in 2009 in London, where I also took a few of my students with me, and they had a chance to talk to the Nobel Award winners, and was also very exciting for them to talk to those people. So work hard and publish your ideas, and use the opportunities we give you at the university, and then you will be in a very nice setup for doing research. So what are the physical and mathematical ingredients? What we look at are micromagnetic properties of nuclei. So we use much of modern physics. We apply homogeneous magnetic fields within the scanner, and here you see the problem, homogeneous. I mean, in principle they are homogeneous, but in practice they won't be that homogeneous, and this implies artifacts. And what we do with the homogeneous vectors is like what you do with the needle of your compass. If you take a magnet, yeah, the needle rotates this way. Yeah? And if we think about our nuclei being all small magnets, and if you apply a strong magnet from the outside, they all get aligned. Yeah? And if you take off the magnet, they start to unalign. And this unalign process is a change of the magnetic field, and this can be measured by induced charges and electricity, and that's the way how very simply simple way of looking at things that is used here for imaging. Then we use the resonance phenomenon that results from the interaction of nuclei with magnetic field. We use Fourier methods for reconstructions because we measure basically Fourier transforms of signals if we measure the magnetic behavior. And we have to use a lot of image enhancement algorithms to generate nice looking images. And for us, and I want to emphasize this again, details in physics are not in the focus of this lecture. I'm not a physicist, yeah? So don't blame me for things that are wrong in terms of physics. There are way smarter people out there. They can deal with these things way better than I do. We will focus on algorithmic aspects, and I will talk about the bias correction. So for instance, if you capture an image of this gentleman here, and you have a very strong light source over there, and you put the spotlight towards this person, and I capture a very nice image of you, yeah, it's clear that from this side your face will have more light than from the other side. And if I want to analyze the surface of your face, the skin structure, I have different intensity values showing the same skin cells basically, yeah. And what I want to do is I want to enforce a homogeneous illumination based on the image that I observe. So I see parts are darker, parts are brighter in the image that show the same situation. And I want to transform the image in a way that the light is homogeneous, that the illumination in the image is homogeneous. That's what we want to consider in the following. And we call the inhomogeneous illumination also bias. You get a bias on the intensities. That means a systematic error on the intensities, and you want to get rid of that. And the question is, how can we deal with that? Yeah. And later we will also formalize this, like we did it in the situation of defect pixel interpolation. We say we have the ideal image. And then we have a so-called bias image and this has, for instance, an intensity ramp here. Yeah. So this is darker, this is brighter, or vice versa. And these two are multiplied, these two images, and at the end you will get an image with the bias. And if we visualize the heart here, you see the heart and the bias field. And what you want to have is you want to reconstruct this. And in contrast to the situation above, we cannot calibrate the bias image. So what we are going to solve is no longer, I don't tell you now how to divide by zero, what we actually managed in the previous chapter. I now tell you how you can factorize a real number into two factors, where one is providing the anatomic information and the other one the artifacts. So I'll tell you, for instance, how to factorize 12 into a unique product, like 6 times 2. So we extend the idea of prime numbers now. So if you go to an algebra lecture, you can tell them, Horneger is telling us how to factorize any real number into a product of two numbers in a unique way. Yeah? You see the problem? There is no solution for that. There is no solution for that. Yeah, we can also say it's 3 times 4, and the question is, what is what? And again, like in the above situation, we will use a certain property of the bias field. Here we will use the fact that the bias field is very smoothly changing. And with this type of information, we will be able to separate the two images and to generate these nice-looking images. That's bias field correction. Yeah? So once again, if you will meet your dad tonight, you can tell him, I know now how to divide by 0, and I'm learning currently how to factorize each natural number by using just 2 numbers in a unique way. Thank you very much, and see you on Monday morning.